This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember cultural historian and scholar Bruce Franklin. In this 1 hour, we interview Bruce about his book titled Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. Bruce Franklin, a regular guest here on Law and Disorder, passed away last week on May 19th at the age of 90. He was one of the country's leading historians and a scholar in American studies, science fiction, and several other diverse fields. Bruce Franklin's memory lives on through his many books and his hundreds of professional articles. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
U.S. Army Ranger turned conscientious objector Rory Fanning recently wrote this in the Guardian newspaper. Sunday, November 11, we celebrated Veterans Day. It used to be called Armistice Day and was a celebration of peace after the slaughter of World War I. Now it's called Veterans Day. The United States has 668 military bases around the globe. The United States has conducted military operations in two-thirds of the world's countries since September 11, 2001. It has spent three-quarters of $1 trillion each year on its military, more than the next 13 countries combined. The U.S. has taken hundreds of thousands of lives around the world these past 14 years and shows no signs of slowing down. Our guest today is H. Bruce Franklin. Bruce Franklin is a former Air Force navigator and intelligence officer, a progressive activist, and the John Cotton Dana Professor of English and American Studies Emeritus at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. He's the author or editor of 19 books and has received lifetime achievement awards from the American Studies Association and other major academic organizations. Bruce Franklin, it's nice to see you. Welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
Bruce, you've just written what Daniel Ellsberg calls a terrific book, and we agree. Tell us how you came to the title.
Okay, well, that's a long story.
We got time.
Okay, so here we are with a dysfunctional government, a educational system which is falling apart, a disgraceful health delivery system destroying our environment, our infrastructure is falling apart, and the thing that we're financing as though there's never any limit is so-called defense making war. Here we are fighting so many wars that if all the listeners started figuring out, well, how many wars are we fighting? Where are we fighting? Everyone would come up with a different number. Nobody knows. If you're in a maze and you're at this really bad place, you want to get out, you got to figure out what was the path that led you into this. So what the American people need is a crash course in the history that led to the present situation. So that's part of it. It's also, though, we're on a crash course. And then trying to figure out, okay, how to really communicate this to people. You can do history, write history, write narrative, and it just kind of goes past everybody. So it occurred to me that what I really need is to go through this using my consciousness, my experience, and the changes that took place for me. So what we end up with is a crash course in the history, and people will not get this history from any other source. Pieces of it are here and there, so this is not all original, but parts of it you cannot get any place else. So this is part of decades of historical scholarship and many more decades of activism and life experience. I'm coming at this as somebody who was a rabid anti-communist. So I know how people who don't agree with what I think now think. So then the crash course goes all the way back. My first real memory of encounters with history was 1939, the World's Fair. And so I went there and had the privilege, we want to call it, of seeing the great future that American corporations were going to give us. And this has just been there in my mind. It's influenced a lot of my work. But then I grew up in World War II. Typical World War II boy.
Bruce, you're 84 years old, and you remembered World War II. And it's been called our good war. What was good about it, and what was bad about it?
Well, the good was what we're supposedly fighting. You know, we were fighting ultra-militarism, fascism. What was bad about it was we lost the war.
How did we lose the war?
We lost the war to the forces that we thought we were fighting. This is not an eccentric opinion. The two great novels that came out of that war, one by Joseph Heller, who is a navigator bombardier, Catch 22, and the other one by someone who was on the ground during the firebombing of Dresden, Slaughterhouse 5, both of them come to the same conclusion. The fascists won that war. And the thing that sealed it are the acts that made us win the war. Finally, those are the acts that made us lose the war. Those are the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th of 45.
Well, let's go into that. I wanted to ask you about that. Because that's something that I've been concerned about since I got politically conscious myself. Story was that the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima to end the war and to save lives. Of course, I always wondered why they dropped a second one on Nagasaki. But in any case, that was the story. And I remember I used to work for the Episcopal Church. And I asked the head of the organization that I worked for, who was an Episcopal priest, and who had been in the Navy in the Second World War, I asked him if he supported the dropping of the atomic bomb. And he said, yes, I did, because it was dropped to save lives. And I had read Guy Alperowitz's book, Atomic Diplomacy, as I imagine you have.
Yeah,
but you have your own thoughts about that, too.
Yeah.
My question to you, Bruce Franklin, is why was the bomb, in fact, two bombs, dropped on Japan in 1945?
That's a bigger question than you may think. Okay, so let's go back to the first thing. The really simple question is, did the bombs end the war? Was it a necessity to drop the bombs to end the war? Well, the fact is that the Japanese were trying to surrender. That's undebatable. What people don't know is that the American people knew that. That is in the book. I've got the evidence. I've got the newspaper articles that were published that they were trying to surrender. So think about it. The invasion of Japan wasn't planned until the following spring, maybe February or March of 46. Would have been possible for President Truman actually to have American troops invading Japan with casualties up clearly in the hundreds of thousands when the American people knew that the Japanese were trying to surrender. I have all kinds of documentation of this. The original proposal was the emperor was going to be allowed to be kept. And then they changed the proposal after the bomb was tested, knowing that the Japanese would not ever accept the unconditional surrender, which they didn't. They didn't accept unconditional surrender. They got to keep the emperor, which we clearly could have had exactly the same settlement. What forced the Japanese to accept something they weren't prepared to accept was not the nuclear bombs. And again, we have the documentary evidence. The bombs were not affecting their decision-making. I mean, the lunatics that were holding out, the ultra-militarist lunatics, in the middle of this debate, so a messenger comes in and informs them about the Nagasaki bombing. They didn't care. It didn't enter their discussion. They said, they thanked him for the information. He bowed and left, and that was it. We have the transcript. What decided them to go with the terms that were offered was the entrance of the Soviet Union into the war. And the biggest land battles of the Pacific theater were fought by the Soviet Union against the main force Japanese armies on the mainland of China. And then, of course, we were told that, you know, the Japanese would never surrender. Hundreds, literally hundreds of Japanese generals surrendered. And they didn't surrender like a token thing. This was a major battle, a huge battle. The Soviets lost 30,000 men killed in this, but they completely crushed the Japanese army. And so we have the transcript. They decided we have to surrender, because if we don't, the Russians are going to enter northern Japan.
Well, that brings me back to where we started, when you say the forces of fascism actually won the war. And I wanted you to elaborate on that. We had the firebombing of Dresden. We had the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What forces of fascism prevailed after 1945? What are we talking about here?
The militarization of our economy, our politics, and central to that, our culture. And this is where I want to get back to my experience, you know, growing up as a kid during the war. So I was a patriotic American boy, all excited about this war, you know, filled with this fervor, you know, like the other boys making model airplanes and so on. The culture of that, which I emerged with, which the American people emerged with, one way to look at that is we're drunk with victory. And, you know, we believed in our military might. But my experience was August 14th, 1945, VJ Day. I'm in the back of a pickup truck, crammed with other kids, and there's an impromptu motorcade in our neighborhood in Brooklyn. And everybody are pouring out of their homes, out in the streets, cheering, dancing, waving American flags, and we kids in the truck were screaming, "Peace, peace, the war is over." And we all believed, not just the kids in the truck, but everybody else, all believed, okay, this is it. We're going to live on a peaceful planet and in a peaceful nation. We had no enemies. There were no threats. Now there was another threat. We have to understand what happened when we dropped those bombs. 69 of the nuclear scientists sent a petition to the president, which never reached him because Leslie Groves stopped it, saying, "Don't use this weapon, because if you use this weapon, eventually the cities of the United States will be threatened by this weapon." So here we are, Homo sapiens, the most intelligent species on the planet. We are so smart, so intelligent, that we figured out how to exterminate ourselves. And not only figured out how to do it, but built it. And that's what happened when we dropped those two bombs. Why? I mean, Michael, you asked the question, why? That's a very complicated question, because Truman thought that what he was doing was ending war for all time. He had read in science fiction in which American presidents had used nuclear weapons to bring perpetual peace. That's what he thought he was doing. So here we are. Then, of course, how did it happen? Wars. The Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Cold War, all started right at the same time, within a few days of each other, of August 14th.
Why, of all the enemies of public liberty, is war, according to our founding father, James Madison, is war the most to be dreaded?
From war, we get taxes, we get power, in the hands of the people who can make the war. You know, what we succeeded in doing was nullifying some of the most important parts of the Constitution. As we all, you know, everybody listening to this knows this, right? The last time we declared war was in early December 1941. And now the president can make war whenever he chooses. Congress has no say in it at all, despite the legislation passed in 75.
During the Cold War with the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, that was the name of the USSR, you were in the United States Air Force. You were in the Strategic Air Command. You were a navigator and an intelligence officer. What did you believe you were accomplishing doing this?
Okay, well, to understand that, you have to figure out, well, what happened to our consciousness? So, you know, during World War II, we were watching movies and seeing the heroism of the Soviet people. You know, they were not only just allies, but they were heroic. And then suddenly, they were transformed with the wave of a magic wand into our enemy. You know, how did that happen? So during the war, one of the icons, the symbols of Japan, was a yellow octopus on the globe. Suddenly, the yellow octopus became a red octopus with the same tentacles trying to take over. None of this was true. It was all made up. But how did that happen? You know, trying to explore my own consciousness. Well, how did this happen? Because certainly by 1948, I was a fervent anti-communist. I think it probably happened by 47. And then so I go back and look at some of the media and other things, but it was all around this transformation of consciousness. Of course, essential to that was the tremendous repression that went on. We had been yelling, "Peace, peace," in the back of that pickup truck. By then, peace had become a dirty word. Because the only people who were in America who was really pushing for peace were supposedly communists and pinkos and fellow travelers and dupes and sympathizers. And so anybody for peace was suspect.
Bruce, let's talk about how the Vietnam War got started, the lies on which that and the Korean War were based.
Okay, so both of them started about the same time. So here we are, we're proclaiming peace, peace. That very day, that's August 14th, 45, was the August Revolution in Vietnam. Vietnam had been occupied by the Japanese. In 2 weeks, the Vietnamese people overthrew Japanese occupation. They imprisoned the Japanese soldiers. And on September 1st, Ho Chi Minh, speaking to 500,000 people in Hanoi, read their Declaration of Independence, which began with a long quotation from our Declaration of Independence. While this is going on, suddenly two warplanes appear overhead. They're P-38. A Lightning, fighter bombers. So the people look up, they recognize these are American planes, and they cheer like one person. They cheer because they knew that the American people would support their independence of this new nation, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. And they were right. They weren't wrong, because if the American people had known anything about it, of course we would have supported their independence. But meanwhile, something else had happened in secret, because on August 22nd, President Charles de Gaulle of France came to Washington and got an agreement with Truman. Truman said, we would support their invasion of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. They would finance it. We would give them all the equipment they needed, and we would divert a whole flotilla of troop ships from bringing GIs home from France to bring that invasion army to Vietnam. And that invasion army would include many POWs who had surrendered to the United States and been turned over to the French and forced into the French Foreign Legion, including whole units of Waffen-SS. Meanwhile, before they could get there with the invasion army, the British landed. They freed the Japanese soldiers. They rearmed them. The RAF and the remnants of the Japanese Air Force bombed and strafed the Vietnamese. So when the American ships arrived in the late fall, these 12 troop ships, who greets them on the docks but uniformed, rearmed Japanese soldiers saluting them on the docks? Above the ships, there's a tower with machine guns manned by Japanese soldiers. So every single enlisted man, every single one, signed a petition denouncing imperialism. That was their word, and demanding to know why we were participating in the subjugation of the American people, of the Vietnamese people. That shows that the Vietnamese people were right about the American people, because they were the American people. These sailors, they supported the head of the OSS in the region, Archimedes Patty. He supported them. Philip Gallagher, who was our main general in that whole area, went on Hanoi radio and sang the national anthem of this new nation. But pretty soon, we had 250 U.S. pilots flying combat missions for the French. It was partly a French war, partly a proxy war for the United States until we took over in 1954. That's Vietnam. But then Korea.
What about Korea?
We want to connect lots of dots here. Okay, so Korea. 3 days before VJ Day, on the night of the 11th, 12th of August, Washington made the decision that we were going to grab a big chunk of Korea. So Dean Rusk, who was an Army colonel then, later Secretary of State, was given 40 minutes to figure out what we would get. So he had an old National Geographic map. He looks at the map. He says, oh, here's the capital, Seoul. Oh, how do we get the capital? Oh, here's the 38th parallel. So we'll just take everything south of the 38th parallel, so we'll get the capital and everything else. Had there been any consultation with the Korean people? Zero, none. Had there been consultation with the Soviet Union? None. So, but then they said to Stalin, okay, this is what we decided. And the myth of the expansionist Soviet Union is punctured when you understand what was actually going on. So the Soviet army had destroyed the Japanese army, fighting with the Soviet troops were Korean forces, largely guerrillas, and they were already coming across the border into Korea and prepared to set up a Korean government, a progressive government, an anti-fascist government. We flew Syng Rhi to this South Korea thing that we had just created to become essentially the dictator. And it's interesting because if you compare these two entities, one actually governed by Koreans who had fought the Japanese, the other governed by Koreans who had supported the Japanese. And I'm not making this up. You know, we historians like to use archival sources. Well, you know, if you use archival sources, you're sort of relying on the honesty of the people who have actually read them. But now we can do things. So wherever possible, I've used archival sources that are available online. Here, one of my main sources, people can read the source. It's a CIA report comparing the governments in the North and South. This is in 1948. This is the year the CIA began operations. And they talk about the government in the North being a popular government, serving the needs of the people. The government in the South is a dictatorship which rests on the power of the wealthy class that had supported the Japanese ever since they occupied the whole country since 05 when Teddy Roosevelt helped them. The dictatorship of Sigmund Rhee and these forces were waging a brutal campaign against the people of the South. They killed by conservative estimates at least 100,000 people in destroying what was an anti-colonial movement.
Bruce Franklin, the author of the just published book, Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Speaking with Bruce Franklin, the author of the just-published book, Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. Noam Chomsky had this to say. I don't want to embarrass you, Bruce, but I wanted to read this for our listening audience. Two threads are skillfully interwoven in this absorbing memoir, the record of a remarkable life with rich and varied experience and astute analysis of the background of critical historical events. The outcome is a fascinating picture of post-World War II America, all under the grim shadow of forever war.
Bruce, you argue that that war, the Vietnam War, which you call an abomination, is the root of the perpetual global wars that the United States of America propagates today. You show it's been related by establishment historians, most recently in the Ken Burns film, as a, quote, noble cause, but a mistake made by well-meaning people. You write that, on the contrary, that the establishment history of the Vietnam War is a necessary cultural foundation for new imperialist wars. How so?
I think the key thing here, because we got a whole bunch of balls up in the air, is how was this possible that we got into this war? What was the nature of that war? How did this and the Korean War and the Cold War evolve into the forever war? To understand where we are now, we have to understand that all of this was based on lies. Daniel Ellsberg, in that wonderful documentary Hearts and Minds, there's a great moment where he goes through the lies about the Vietnam War of the five administrations, beginning with Truman. And then he says, it's a great tribute to the American people that our leaders found it necessary to lie to us. Then he pauses and says, but it's not a great tribute to us that it was so easy. These were imperialist wars. I mean, the chronology that I just gave before is a chronology which completely blows apart the Burns Novak documentary. It was not honorable intentions in either Vietnam or Korea. And what happened to me was not hardly unique. It was happening to millions and then tens of millions of American people, as we learned about the lies. We began to understand what this war was about because it made no sense that it kept going on. And then, when the Tet Offensive came in '68, anybody had any sense realized that the Vietnamese people were on the other side. What just a few months before, in 67, Martin Luther King had said that great speech, "We're fighting on the wrong side of a world revolution." And so people began to understand the nature of the war and the nature of the relationship between our government and us. And this is where we connect the dots up to this tremendously divided nation that we live in right now. Because there's one thing that cuts right across that divide, is that left, right, red state, blue state, the American people believe this government does not represent us. This is a government that does not act in our interest. Well, when did that happen? Fortunately, we have some scientific data here, because every 2 years, the University of Michigan conducts surveys, and one of the about American attitudes. And starting in 54, they asked the question, is the government run for the benefit of all the people, or is it run for the benefit of a few big interests? So in 54, 76% of the American people said it's run for the benefit of all. 74, that was 20 years later, this had flipped. So there were now 66%, that's two-thirds of the American people, believed that the government was run for the benefit of a few big interests. This is a dramatic change in consciousness, and it kept going with the one little blip going the other way was right after 9/11. But the last figures I looked at was 2012. By 2012, what were the numbers? 79% of the American people believed that the government was run for a few big interests, and only something like 16% believed it was run for the benefit of all. This cuts right across. Now, the bad guys here have been real clever about how they played this. So Reagan was a master of it. Trump is very good at it. Somehow positioning themselves that they're somehow different from the government. So Reagan could say, "Oh, the worst news you ever want to hear is I'm from the government and I'm here to help." So he says this, he's president of the United States. He's denouncing the government. How does this make sense? So Trump plays the I'm draining the swamp card, and so he's got a base that believes this. So the consciousness changed. People who read the Pentagon Papers, which were released in 71, actually saw in print, we got to be a fly on the wall, how our leaders thought about the relationship with us. Because Johnson wanted more data on plausibility of denial. In other words, what he wanted was more information about how stupid or gullible we would be. And people came to understand this. And, you know, that movement, which played such a key role in the war, especially the movement within the Army and Navy and eventually Air Force, of all things, has not gone away. When the Iraq War began, the protests against that war were actually bigger than the protests against the Vietnam War. So the American people, I don't know anybody who supports these wars. And I spent a lot of time with white, male, working-class guys, you know, spending long hours fishing with them and talking about all kinds of things. They don't support this war. No one supports these wars.
I don't even think people can articulate why we're involved in these wars. Bruce, what kind of a reception have you been getting for your book, Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War?
Well, it's hard to tell. I'm only getting sympathetic. It's gone into at least two printings, maybe three so far. So some people buy it. It's not going to be a bestseller. You know, it is a crash course. It's a lot of stuff in that book. It's kind of novelistic in style. So there's humorous things. There's a love story about my love with
Well, speaking of the love story, because Michael and I are huge fans of your companion and comrade, Jane Franklin, can you talk a bit about her accomplishments over these many years, especially with respect to the defense of the Cuban Revolution?
Yeah, well, we've been married 62 years. I had the privilege of accompanying Jane when she went to Cuba in 2015, when her new book on the relationship between Cuba and the United States came out. And of course, she's a national celebrity there. It was amazing because, well, she was on Cuban national TV a number of times. You know, for decades, every member of the Cuban foreign ministry has been required to read her book. And so ordinary working people were coming up to us, La Escritora, you know, the writer, I'm going to buy your book. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, ordinary working people are going to buy this history book? You know, hey, this is not United States. This is something else. And I'm trying to think of a parallel. I'm thinking, well, if Jane had been a rock star and written an autobiography with a lot of hot sex scenes, I could understand people say, oh, yeah. But no, this is a history book. She's just gotten, you know, overwhelmed with all kinds of wonderful messages on coming back to her on email. So, yeah, so, you know, we developed the FBI documents. We just turned several thousand pages to the Berkeley archives. The FBI documents, they think that Jane was the really radical one. So anyway, I don't agree with that.
Well, she started off as a nice Southern girl.
Yeah. So yeah, she's a farm girl. You know, grew up on a farm in North Carolina, tobacco farm. I grew up in Brooklyn, and one of the interesting things is that we have been learning from each other about the United States throughout our relationship.
Bruce, I was fascinated to read about your experience working on the waterfront, where I live now in Red Hook. You were on a tugboat out there. I wanted to ask you about that. How did you find working out on a tugboat with a really tough scene?
Yeah, well, that chapter is called On the Waterfront because I found myself in a war scene. There was a war raging all around me. This was one of the things that was penetrating my consciousness and reality, penetrating it and showing me that my conception of America was not accurate. And I guess the most dramatic moment came, I was on the prow of a tugboat standing on the rotten ropes that were used for a bunker about to cast a line, and I see something in the water. It turns out to be a guy's body, and as we get ready to fish him out, I see the bag hook sticking in the back of his neck, which was the sign that he'd been executed by the mob. So I didn't understand a lot of what was going on around me, but later did the research and discovered that, hey, how did this happen that the mob got control of the waterfront? Well, it was another little factor about World War II, the so-called Good War. The Navy made a formal agreement with the mob to give them control of the waterfront to preserve labor peace. The movie On the Waterfront is anti-communist propaganda, which absolutely reverses the reality of the scene there. I go into that.
And that was the beginning of the Gambino crime family, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, then you moved on from the tugboat. You started, you were in ROTC, and you became an officer in the Air Force. You were flying planes that refueled bombers that flew over the Soviet Union. And how did you feel about what you were doing then?
Well, when I went in, I mean, I was a true believer. I thought I was going to be part of a great mission of defending the United States and the world from the communist menace, and in particular from the vast fleets of Soviet bombers that were ready, poised to attack the United States with nuclear weapons. So this was duck and cover days, you know, like in Atomic Cafe, that great movie. So one of the things that I discovered, because I was not only a navigator, but also I was a squadron intelligence officer, was that the Soviet bomber fleets consisted of exactly zero bombers. They had no means to deliver nuclear weapons to the United States. So this was all lies. It was a hoax. It was designed to build the power of SAC to enrich Boeing and Lockheed and the other so-called defense contractors. So that was one thing. And then the main thing we were doing was mid-air refueling. It was an Arctic squadron of B-47s and B-52s that were engaged in two kinds of missions. One, espionage missions, which were classified top secret because they wanted them to make it. And the other were provocation missions, where the whole idea was to make the Soviet Union believe that we were about to attack. So all of this didn't fit with my World War II childish consciousness. And then another discovery, quite by chance, you know, Curtis LeVay, who madman, my first boss, and then Thomas Power, the guy who took over Strategic Air Command, they really wanted to bomb the Soviet Union. And I've always wondered, for a long time, why didn't they? Because, you know, they had this vast fleet of B-47s. That was the main bomber. And then they had the B-52s coming in. Well, one day we were about to refuel a B-47. I was talking to the aircraft commander. He was talking to me in mid-sentence. He breaks off. They had just exploded right behind us. And then 5 days later, another one exploded in midair, just like that. So I was able, because I was in intelligence, to do some research then and began to find out this was a little wider than they were pretending, but I didn't get the real stuff until, you know, way later of what was actually going on. So what was going on was the SAC realized that the B-47 could not penetrate Soviet air defenses at altitude. So they're coming in on the deck below the radar and then pretending to release their nuclear weapons and then coming back in a big loop, flying back over like a fighter plane, but it's not a fighter plane. So this is causing metal fatigue in the center wing section, like you're bending a beer can until it falls apart. And when it's split, the fuel lines go right through that. So they blew up. And the Air Force had to ground all the B-47s and go through this Operation Milk Bottle to beef them up, blah, blah, blah. Some of it was leaking out because where the one that blew up behind us happened was within sight of Buffalo, and another one blew up over Tulsa. So they couldn't conceal the thing completely. But they said this was that the problem was affecting only a tiny minority of all the B-47s that were flying. So the actual statistics are that in a two-year period, they lost 58 B-47s. And compare that, the number of B-47s flying at that time was exactly the same as the combined United Airlines and American Airlines fleets. So you can imagine 58 airliners lost in 2 years. So they may not have felt that they really had what it would take to launch. But, you know, we came terribly close.
Stanford University hired you, and then they fired you. What was your offense?
Well, they hired me, and then I left to go to Johns Hopkins, and they hired me back with tenure.
Oh.
Because I said, hey, they wanted me back. And I said, hey, I don't want to come back and give a speech and find out the next day I'm being fired for giving a speech. Because that's exactly what happened. I was fired for speech. And in their decision, they said the reason they had to fire me, quote, because rehabilitation is not a useful concept in this case.
That's a real honor.
Because Professor Franklin's perception of reality is too deeply held. These are word-for-word quotes. And they were right. So, you know.
What did you say?
I was blacklisted and completely unemployable for 3 years. And then I was hired by Rutgers in Newark, which was true salvation. So for about 40 years, the state of New Jersey was paying me and giving me a named chair for saying the same things that I was fired for saying at Stanford.
I was struck in your book, Crash Course, when you write about how you got the job at Rutgers and the dean called you up after you announced that you were going to teach a course on Vietnam. And you thought, uh-oh, this is it. And instead he said, do you need some extra money to show movies?
Yeah. Well, Rutgers knew it was a great institution. It's 15 years in a row, the most multi-ethnic research university in the United States. My colleagues, my students, I just love teaching there. It's a wonderful experience.
And our hero, Arthur Conoy, used to teach there in the law school.
Yeah, and had a devoted following for
yes,
Arthur.
Yeah. Bruce, what happened in 1991?
Well, here, from 45 on, the main goal of our society was stopping the Soviet Union, winning the Cold War. So there we were, 1991, Soviet Union doesn't exist. Okay, it's time for our peace dividend, right? We could spend things on health and education and the environment, things like that. But just by coincidence, that was the year that the war in Iraq began. So we moved very clearly from the Cold War to the Forever War.
Do you think that the government, which was so determined to overcome what they called the Vietnam Syndrome, that is to roll back anti-war attitudes and feelings in the United States, you think they've succeeded in that, or is there an anti-war movement here?
Well, I think the American people don't want war. They don't support this war. We're not given opportunities to vote on this. But the government, I'm not just talking about this administration, but every administration realizes they're in a bind. They're really desperate because they're fighting what we properly call imperialist wars, and they can't get a large army out there. They learned their lesson in Vietnam. They cannot fight this war with a conscript army. So what are they going to do? Drones, special forces, have as wide a gulf as they can possibly get between the people in service and the civilian population. Make the people in service believe that the civilian population is other, and make the civilian population believe that the people in service are others. So I was just wearing my Veterans for Peace hat till people come up to me, oh, thank you for your service. And that's how we're supposed to behave now. Thank you for your service. When people say that to me, I don't start giving a lecture on the spot, so I just say, well, thank you. But when I think back, when I was in SAC, we launched three times. Real thing.
When you were in the Strategic Air Command.
We launched. We launched three times, and we were just barely recalled. And when I think about it, it's the most painful and embarrassing and terrifying thought, is I realized that never, not for a second, did the thought ever enter my mind, should I be doing this?
What terrifies me, and it seems to me a miracle, and I wondered whether you agree with me, it seems to me a miracle that there hasn't been a nuclear war yet.
It is a miracle. I have a whole thing. I discovered that the guy who cut our wedding cake back in 56 commanded a destroyer who almost started World War III in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis by dropping depth charges on a Russian submarine that was armed with nuclear torpedoes. That was a very close call. We've had many close calls because of computer malfunctions or people putting a training tape into a computer. Gary Hart and Barry Goldwater formed a study. The Senate had them do it. And they found that this was like routine, all these false alarms. And if we go for a space force, then decision-making will be entirely in the hands of computers. And people, one thing people have to understand, that it's not true that only the president has the authority and the ability to launch a nuclear war. That is widely dispersed among hundreds of individuals who have the power to actually launch a nuclear war, including our nuclear submarines, each of which has 124 thermonuclear warheads, each several times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb.
On that sobering note, I think we've run out of our allotted time, Bruce Franklin. Heidi and I want to thank you for the terrific book you've written, Crash Course from the Good War to the Forever War. One last thing. How can our audience follow your work?
The easiest way is to go to my website, which is hbrucefranklin.com. It's just my name, hbrucefranklin.com. And I have events there that people could come to, like book signings and things like that. So.
Bruce, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for this important contribution.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You take it easy.
That was an interview in memory of cultural historian and scholar Bruce Franklin.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.